I'm your host, Carlita, and welcome back to Sailing Beyond Knowledge, episode 16. Thank you for joining us again, and this episode is a very special episode because we have Trevor James Constable with us today, and I want to give listeners a detailed bio of his life and work before you listen to the interview that I had with him. Because there is just so much to cover. He's an extraordinary man, and he has given us an extraordinary gift for being able to produce and tap into an abundant source of water to address our problems of drought, as well as addressing our problems of air pollution and smog with his pioneering technology of engineering the ether. So I hope that you're going to enjoy listening to the interview with him today. But first, you can listen to a bio, which is about 16 minutes or so of his life, because he has had such an extraordinary life and he has done many extraordinary things and worked with wonderful people who have all at some point given their own contribution of research to humanity. Trevor James Constable is a trailblazing legend, so to speak, and I'm greatly privileged to speak to him, and I hope that the information in this podcast is useful to people. Please pass it on, download it, copy it, do whatever you want with it, but do distribute this information because it's very important for us as a community and as a humanity as a whole. Enjoy. I'll speak to you again in episode 17.
Carlita, thank you again, and I will talk to you soon. I urge all your listeners to keep tuning in to Sailing Beyond Knowledge Radio.
Trevor James Constable was born in Wellington, New Zealand in 1925 and educated in that country at Rongotai College and Mackenzie Engineering Academy. He came to the USA in 1952 and has been a naturalized citizen for over half a century. His varied career has included 31 years as a merchant marine radio officer under the flags of three different countries, New Zealand, Great Britain, and the USA. He served in the US Merchant Marine for over 26 years prior to his 1992 retirement, including several tours on the Vietnam Sealift. His Merchant Marine service involved more than 300 ocean crossings of the eastern North Pacific. During this period, he developed original methods of geometrically engineering rain without the use of chemicals or electromagnetic radiation. This original practical research has been based on the foundational discoveries of the late Dr. Willem Reich, MD. One of those most controversial figures in the 20th century, Dr. Reich died in federal prison in 1957, and the American government burned and banned his research and books. These banned books have since been restored to the world market, and you can obtain some of his work through the WilhelmReichMuseum.org. Dr. Willem Reich, MD, invented a weather modification device which he called the Cloudbuster, many versions of which have been used since in different parts of the world. The Cloudbuster uses no chemicals or electromagnetic radiation and was the harbinger of tomorrow's technology in view of Mr. Constable, which will be based on life force, vital force, or ether. Trevor took initiative and at his own expense to investigate further the Cloudbuster invention 38 years ago. He has been successful in miniaturizing and simplifying the original designs. He has proved out his findings with many hours of compelling time-lapse videotape, mostly shot on the high seas in pristine conditions of the weather and ocean. Simplification and drastic size reduction ultimately included modification both to equipment and the methods, so so that these devices could be carried on the light aircraft or helicopters. Successful airborne operations have been carried out in Hawaii, Malaysia, and the People's Republic of China. Trevor's career has also included service in the commercial broadcasting and advertising agency business as a copywriter, skills he further developed in the field of aviation history, where he has earned an international reputation and respect as a chronicler of famous fighter aces, not only US aces, but those of German Luftwaffe in World War II. Surviving German aces of World War II regard his book about the Luftwaffe fighter arm as their monument. His aviation books have been translated into many languages, including German, Japanese, French and Afrikaans, Czech and Finnish, among others. Trevor and his literary partner, Colonel Ray Tolliver, U.S. Air Force retired, are the official biographers of Colonel Erich Hartmann of Germany, the most successful fighter ace in world history. The German translation of their Hartmann biography has sold more than 300,000 copies in some 38 printings, one of the most successful trade books in German publishing history. In addition to being a personal friend of Erich Hartmann and his family over the decades, Trevor and Colonel Tolliver are also the official biographers of the legendary Adolf Galland, general of the Luftwaffe fighter pilots in World War II and a personal friend of more than 35 years until his death in 1998. Trevor has authored 10 non-fiction books, four of them in partnership with Colonel Ray Tolliver, who was for over 25 years the historian of the American Fighter Aces Association. The roots of Trevor James Constable's weather engineering work lies in his personal investigation of UFO phenomenon, on which he has written two books. His masterwork is undoubtedly his Cosmic Pulse of Life, The Revolutionary Biological Power Behind UFOs, originally published in 1976. This book is still in print and recognized as both a mind-bender and pathbreaker. Trevor found that the etheric force he uses in his range engineering is the same energy behind those mysterious flying objects we term UFOs. Western formal science does not recognize the existence of ether, etheric force, or vital force. However, one wishes to characterize this energy. Trevor Constable went heavily into UFO investigation back in 1957, basing his research and field operations in the assumption that UFOs are the component of an invisible level of life and action. This invisibility factor is sharply evident in numerous radar sightings during and since World War II that have not been visually confirmed by pilots vectored to the objects on radar-guided intercept. Numerous UFOs worldwide have been reported to dematerialize, to vanish while under observation. Similarly, UFOs have been seen to materialize into sight under clear sky conditions from out of nowhere. Trevor's photographic research was a simple, direct approach to looking beyond the normal visible spectrum. He uses infrared film, which records invisible light. Lo and behold, he found another range of form exists objectively, which we do not see with our own unaided eyes. Pursuit of this approach brought convincing evidence that there exists in our atmosphere an unseen level of life that has probably existed alongside our own for millennia. There are also constructs present in that same invisible level of existence. Engineered objects that are propelled by manipulations of etheric force. When the life forms, or critters as Trevor James calls them, and the constructs emerge occasionally into the visible spectrum, where we see them visually, they are mutually confused. Trevor's discovery therefore introduces a much-needed qualitative element into ufology, which he claims will take generations to explore and understand. Common functioning principle involved in both UFO categories is the biological energy that animates the critters and propels the craft. The visitors who have engineered the craft have achieved technical mastery of etheric force, which our brightest minds continue to deny compulsively. That is how Trevor James Constable came to start on his long pursuit of life force, the biological energy. This eventually led via thousands of practical rain engineering operations on the high seas and ashore in several countries to the airborne rain engineering methods of today. These methods will eventually allow mankind to access the billions of tons of water in the cosmic expanse above us. Curse of drought can be lifted from this planet by this means. This is not a blessing which the oligarchic power controllers of our world wish to see eventuate. They wish to control the world's water resources, forcing high water prices on desperate and distressed people. Trevor emphasizes also that no chemicals or electric power or electromagnetic energy in any form are used to produce the demonstrated effects. These methods are environmentally pure. Trevor also classes the airborne translator or P-Gun as the simplest technology device in the world, an empty hollow tube. Before formally trained scientists and technical people rise to squash any such ideas as bizarre, it is wise to bear in mind what NASA's countless billions in expenditures have done to unwittingly verify that Trevor's original approach to UFOs nearly 50 years ago was right on target. On a budget of under $200 a month, he was ridiculed then, especially his contention that UFOs were from invisible domain and appeared to us only sporadically. In 1996, NASA mounted its Vision STS-75 using the Columbia shuttle 300 miles up, a satellite attached to the shuttle by a special power generating cable called a tether. The tether broke loose and drifted, cable and all, more than 70 miles astern of the orbiting Columbia. The entire sequence was recorded on ultraviolet videotape. Dozens of luminous UFOs were recorded in the ultraviolet range, which the astronauts in the shuttle manifestly could not see visually when asked by mission control on the ground to describe what they could observe. Mission control, seeing on the ground several dozen UFOs in the ultraviolet spectrum, which the shuttle's specially designed ultraviolet sensitive camera was recording on videotape. This entire astounding sequence is now in the public domain, on YouTube or videotape. It's recorded and available publicly for personal viewing. These UFOs look shockingly like Trevor Constable's critters photographs made on the Californian high desert in 1957. Not only that, they are also the same objects seen on NASA's photographs of the moon during the Clementine journey. You can download those photographs from the US NASA's US Geographic Survey website, and you can look for these critters on the moon. Also, Jose Escamilla refers to them as Dropus. Furthermore, the ultraviolet video clearly shows great detail of these spinning objects, and they also materialize into the ultraviolet while you watch and dematerialize out of it. The ultraviolet is a harmonic relative of the infrared. So here on the NASA video recorded objectively are some of the great riddles of ufology. With all the mystery stripped away, UFOs dwell in and come and go from an invisible range of vibration, just as Trevor James Constable held to be in 1957. Having been basically right about all of this for so long, and surviving the violent firestorm of the opposition and denial at the time and since then, Trevor may again be right today. This time he speaks of the physical reality of the ether and its geometric accessibility and technological use in the etheric realm. He provides objective video evidence of his views and theories. He envisions a coming era when our entire planetary civilization will be powered by etheric force. in a better world when the dishonest, greedy and dishonourable lords of our present and anti-civilization have been disposed and replaced by human beings dedicated to life and love instead of destruction, disease, death and greed. Trevor's nearly 40 years in pioneering weather engineering included development of a successful means of reducing metropolitan smog. After lengthy experimentation with etheric vortex generating equipment at sea, he began tackling smog in Los Angeles, California, the worst polluted metro region in America. These programs were pre-notified to official sources and undocumented successes. In 1990, he organized and managed Operation Clincher as a full-season anti-smog operation covering the four huge countries in the South Coast Air Quality Management District. The responsible smog authority in the filthiest atmospheric region of USA, Operation Clincher, with 14 stations using Constable equipment, produced an astounding 24% reduction in smog alert days over the entire season. The lowest smog on record in Southern California. This was the worst seasonal knot across the board that Los Angeles smog had ever taken. The Journal of Borderland Research in California published an extensive article covering this achievement, which included pre-notification to the authorities. No official body or corporate groups were even slightly interested in Operation Clincher. Everyone was already invested in pollution, not in its abolition. A world-famous personage playing a key role in the Operation Clincher team was the late General Curtis Emerson LeMay, U.S. Air Force retired, former Chief of State of the USAF, and founder of the Strategic Air Command. Impressed by the success of Clincher, in which he ran an anti-smog device on his own property, the distinguished general intended to bring the whole technological innovation to the attention of the U.S. Air Force. His death at 83, immediately prior to Clincher's triumph completion, prevented this development. In 1988, George K. C. Wu aided the funding of Trevor James Constable's etheric rain engineering operations. Since then, the two worked together to bring the rain engineering operations to governments worldwide, and some very prominent landmark operations were held in places such as Malaysia, where great achievements were made to rid long-term drought with their rain engineering operations. This technology is available today for governments to use worldwide to remedy drought in places such as Africa, Asia and Australia, and in America today where they're experiencing drought. So the etheric rain engineering is a great gift that has been developed by Trevor James Constable to humanity, and with growing awareness that is happening around the world, I believe that this etheric rain engineering project will be more available to humanity. So we have an interview with Trevor after this very long bio, which was really necessary because in order to understand Trevor James Constable's work, it's important to know the details of his incredible life and background, and the amount of self-funding and time and energy that he has put into his research and work is just astounding. He really is a legendary engineer of the ether, and he's taken it upon himself to develop Willem Ryk's work and has come up with some just incredible results. I hope you do go to Trevor's website, which is www.rainengineering.com, where you can also get in touch with George K. C. Wu, the Chairman and Chief Executive Officer, for inquiries into rain engineering. and do your own research and self-educate and teach yourself how you can engineer the weather, so to speak, for your own communities if you're having problems with drought. The information is out there. I will be leaving various links for your research in the summary to the podcast. And I really do hope that people use this information, because it's a powerful tool for self-sustainability, a real gift that Trevor has given to humanity as a whole. So it's been a great honor to have him on our show, and I hope you enjoy listening to the interview, which will be after this music. Welcome to Sailing Beyond Knowledge, Trevor. Thank you so much for giving us your time and coming onto the show and sharing information with us. It's a great honor.
My pleasure.
Well, it's a great honor for me anyway. And what I'll do is I'll start by giving listeners a brief on your extraordinary work and life. You were born in New Zealand in 1925. And
that is correct.
Yeah, and
that is correct.
You studied at Mackenzie Engineering Academy.
Yes, that's now gone altogether.
Oh, really?
As far as I know.
And in 1952, you arrived in the USA, where you lived as a naturalized citizen for over 50 years. And you've written some 10 books.
Right, 10 nonfiction books.
That's amazing. And some of those books I think listeners will be very interested in. I will be giving some details where they can access those books on the summary next to the podcast here.
Uh-huh.
And
good.
One of the books that is quite popular with the alternative community is The Cosmic Pulse of Life, which you...
That's the current book. That is the important one.
Yes, we'll go back to that in a moment. But the other ones that I noticed that might be of interest to listeners as well are Sky Creatures, which you wrote in 1978. And
was put out by a New York publisher,
uh-huh,
by a woman in that house that was determined to have it come out. And she got into a loggerhead situation with the publisher, who didn't want to do it. And he said, "You got to take out all that stuff about the devil if you're going to publish it." And so she had a real war to get it out. So it's really
controversial.
You know, a truncated version of Cosmic Pulse, and it's not too satisfactory from my point of view.
Okay, and then the Loom of Future Weather Engineering. That was in 1994.
Right.
Yeah, and
that's coming out again, by the way, very soon, within the next 90 days, I think it's going to be reissued.
Oh, wonderful.
By the Book Tree in San Diego.
Okay. Well, I'm assuming that will probably be available on the Borderlands website as well.
No, you have to get it directly from the publisher.
Okay.
Yeah.
And another one I noticed was called Spacemen, Friends and Foe, which came out in 1956.
Yes.
Yeah.
That was the first thing I ever published.
Oh, wow.
And it led to the issue of They Live in the Sky.
Yes, yeah.
Thereafter. But it's really just a monograph, the Spacemen, Friends or Foes.
Okay.
I had kind of half forgotten about that now.
Sorry.
So long ago.
Well, and for 31 years you worked as a marine radio officer under the flags of three different countries, England, or I should say the British Isles, the USA and New Zealand. And you spent some time travelling the oceans of the East and North Pacific, some 300 ocean crossings.
That is correct.
Quite impressive,
yeah.
That is. And during the 1950s and the 1990s, you spent a lot of time adapting and pioneering geometrically engineered rain without the use of chemicals and electromagnetic radiation, based on Dr. William Reich's work.
Right, that is correct.
You also investigated beyond that with infrared cameras and ultraviolet, beyond the human five senses, investigating organisms that inhabit realms that we just cannot perceive with the naked eye.
That's very spectacular.
That
led the American government, to develop a special camera that would objectify these. It is a tape recorder that reacts to ultraviolet radiation, and there in the ultraviolet are all the things that I photographed in the infrared, because the infrared is a harmonic of the ultraviolet.
Right.
So, but I did that back in the 50s.
Yeah, and NASA used that, well, they probably still are using that technique for projects out in space. We'll go back to that a bit later, though.
Okay, all right.
There's a few things I want to cover here, and I'm being a bit ambitious, really, because I want to talk about quite a few things, such as the ether, chi and orgone, your work specifically on rain engineering, and which is quite a political and social subject, really. There's a lot that stems from that, and it's very challenging.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's very challenging to science to deal with it.
Yeah.
Because it forces you to accept the existence of the ether.
Yeah, that's
which has been put to bed by Einstein, and nobody has been willing to look at it since.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing. This is why we need to go back to ether first of all before we start talking about the rain engineering, and I want to also talk about the plasma orbs, the beings that you call critters, a bit later on.
We just subsume them under the term critters because there's far too many of them to begin putting them into boxes like a regular biologist do.
Yeah, well, this is something that I would love to do sometime, possibly a long, long way from now, but being an ecologist, I would be fascinated to learn about the ecology of these creatures before.
Right.
Yeah, but okay, let's start by working our way from ether, and I mean, this is probably a question millions of people have asked you. I mean, it's not something we can really delve into deeply because it's such a vast subject, so I will be recommending listeners to go to your Rain Engineering website, which is www.rainengineering.com, and there's a great deal of information there which Trevor James Constable has very generously put onto the website, and listeners can research a lot of the information that we talk about here today on that website. I mean, there's so much there. It's quite a good site to educate oneself to start researching from. But I'm from that site. There's quite a bit on ether, and it breaks it down into four separate parts: warm ether, light ether, chemical ether, and life ether.
I don't know
if you want to talk a little bit about that.
The one we deal with in rain engineering is the chemical ether. That is the important one from that viewpoint. We're dealing with that all the time. Wilhelm Reich, for example, actually made the chemical ether luminate in a vacuum, and made it evident that way, that it was there. And up on the moon, when the astronauts got out in their suits and were walking around on the moon, as they communicated with their base, the fact that the radio on their back was irradiating their ether, which was outside their suit, they got a blue radiance around them that came out several feet.
Mm-hmm.
And it made it perfectly obvious that there was something quite objective there that could be objectified under those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether they ever looked at Wilhelm Reich's work because the government burned that.
That's right.
So they didn't want them to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Wilhelm Reich made the ether illuminate in a vacuum tube, and it did work, and there's photographs of it, of his doing it. So it came full circle when the astronauts got out on the moon and started talking back and forth, and every time they spoke, the blue aspect of their force field would illuminate outside the suit.
Mm-hmm.
So very interesting.
It's amazing. This ether is such a complex primordial substance that all life is connected to, and it's something that is very interesting in respect to obviously why Reich's work was so radical. How is it you came about Reich's work and developing his work? How did that lead you into experimenting with rain engineering?
Well, I got interested in the unidentified flying objects phenomenon back in the 40s or 50s, a long time ago, let's put it that way.
Mm.
And I was looking at everything that possibly pertained to it, including Dr. Reich's work, which was the most comprehensive work that had been done by any scientific worker. And I followed along with it and became acquainted with the principles that stood behind it, and his daughter, the late Dr. Eva Reich, who died just recently in the last year, she guided me into his work so that I didn't get off track, which is very easy for some people to do.
Wow.
when they get into that work.
Yeah.
They tend to ignore the basic work that he published, which was the function of the orgasm.
Yeah.
And that is a key a book for everybody to read that wants to know about Wilhelm Reich, because everything stems from the function of the orgasm. That is where the juice is in the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all my weather engineering work goes back to that. So it's, you know, quite obvious that it was a very revolutionary finding. No other scientist in history had wanted to find out what the function of the orgasm was, even though it's at the very roots of physical existence, that none of us would be here if it wasn't for the orgasm. So, and they still resist it. They still resist it like crazy.
Yeah.
Because they have difficulties with their sexual processes, which most human beings do, and, therefore, they can't deal with it. This is why, you know, we have never been able to really market these processes for controlling the weather in the fashion that is clearly obvious. It does work. There's no doubt about it. I have a suitcase full of time-lapse tapes showing it working.
Mm.
So no one can say that they haven't seen it.
Do you think you'll ever get those on digital CDs for people?
Well, I could put out probably 40 or 50 CDs with all the time-lapse film that I have, the time-lapse tape.
Yeah.
I bought a commercial tape recorder back in the 80s when I was on the Maui, and I actually wore that machine out taking time-lapse tapes with it. Very hard on a tape recorder to use it that way, and I just simply wore it out. I had to just get rid of it. But I also have the material benefit of looking at those tapes anytime I want to, and also showing them to people who prove to be fit to see them, and also showing them to presidents and prime ministers and people like that, and scaring the hell out of them. Anybody that thinks they're tough should take a look at those tapes, because they show up as mostly frightened by it when you tell them that you have a system that uses neither chemicals nor electric power, and you control the weather with it. You can make it rain with this. Well, they want to get under the table or out of the room. It just it frightens them. It's really something.
So
both myself and Mr. Wu have seen that particular reaction amongst high officials all over the world.
So this work at the moment is shared between you and George K.C. Wu.
Mm-hmm.
Have you recently had any inquiries regarding demonstrations and using it? Because in the handbook that you sent me, it's very, very detailed, and you do specify that due to the political and social issues that are raised with this, because it's such a controversial subject, that you don't give demonstrations?
Yeah, we don't give demonstrations as such to anybody, because we can show them a situation that is virtually identical with theirs on this time-lapse film, which there's no way in the world that you can fake that.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way you can fake it. And they use that as a means of getting out of confronting the whole problem. So that's the way it stands. It's just it's really a functioning of what Dr. Reich called human armoring, and that's just like body armor that a human wears, except that this is a person, the way that a person prevents himself coming into contact with something that animates his own sexual processes. They are not able to handle that. That's all there is to it. And, lots of people all over the world are suffering because of this, the work having been done to provide rain, especially in tropical countries. I mean, you can make it rain in a way that you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
I've got film of that.
Yeah.
It just comes down with the bucket still around it.
it must have taken a lot of times of going out to really understand the nature of how the ether worked and which directions it was cycling around the globe
and oscillate. Well, this is the reason that they are not able to do anything with hurricanes, for example, is that they don't understand that it is due to the superimposition of two streams of cosmic energy that creates a hurricane to begin with.
Yeah.
Dr. Reich elucidated all that for him in his lifetime.
Yeah.
And, published photographs used photographs that NASA had taken in the early days that conclusively proved that was how it was done. And, they just don't want to advance into etheric science. That's what it amounts to.
But it's not just because of the fact that they would have to face a whole lot of reevaluating official science. It's also
that is correct.
It's also
they would have to reevaluate. I mean, you're a scientist. You know that that you'd have to reevaluate a lot of things that are the bedrock of your degree.
Absolutely.
You would have to do that.
Yeah, but it's the other part of it is because of the kind of power agenda that is gained from suppressing this knowledge. And
people get involved in the existing ways of doing things. They get involved in it economically.
Yeah.
And, they have got to watch that they don't lose their jobs. You can understand that. Because if you lose your job, you then have the stigma of having had that happen to you, and you're not quite so welcome elsewhere, unless you happen to run into someone like me as an employer.
So, with your aerial experiments with rain engineering, you have two hollow tubes attached to either of wings of the aeroplane.
Uh-huh. One tube now. We don't need the two.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
9 inches long.
So, it just goes across the main wing.
Yeah, just tie it. You don't even need to have to put it out on the wing struts or anything like that. You can take it inside the cabin of the aeroplane and it works in there just as well.
And what's the metal that's used for the hollow tube?
The metal is the tubes that we use now are made in Japan by a ceramics organization there.
Okay.
The tube is made of ceramic and it's coated with copper.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, and mirrored, of course. You've got a two-way mirror on the end of it, and that's it. And it works fine. Because it allows you to intercept the ether and to push the ether back, and when you push it back, it builds up. And when it builds up, it attracts moisture from the atmosphere to itself, just like a magnet. And you see, rain just appear, and it comes, and it keeps coming for quite some time after you originally get it going.
Okay.
It is very, very fascinating. But you also are likely to do a lot of damage if you attempt this in a built-up area. You'll have, for example, your electric high voltage transformers, and that will blow out. And all your in the banks, they have these the automatic teller machines that they gobble up the cards and keep the cards.
Can't
get them back. This has happened. We have to be very careful about where we do it, because the ether goes through everything. It's in everything, and there's nothing you can do to insulate it, really.
Oh wow, this is just fascinating. It really is just wonderful stuff. I mean, briefly, on and off, I've come across Wright's work. I remember when I was 14, I read a book by Rudolf Steiner, and
yes, he's another great man.
Yeah, and
Steiner put me where I am today, yeah, more than anyone else.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yes.
So you discovered Steiner before Reich's
book? Yes, I did. Yes.
Uh-huh. What was it about his main principles that sort of shaped your own work? What did you draw from Steiner?
The teacher that I had in the very early days, back in the 50s, was a man named Dr. Franklin Thomas. He was an optometrist and also a publisher in Los Angeles. And he gave me a book on Steiner and said, you've got to get familiar with this, because this is what you need to undergird your further development. You won't go anywhere if you don't understand Steiner or give it some attention. And that was actually 100% true. That turned out to be a great benefit to me all my life, without a doubt. And it also made it possible for me to understand what Wilhelm Reich had done, because I had that background laid by Rudolf Steiner beforehand. It was very, very obviously, that the two dovetailed very well. Although Reich and Steiner never met each other. They never knew each other, even though they're both Austrians at the same time.
Wow. And you also mention in your website the work of Gunther Waschmuth. How do you pronounce his surname? Is it Waschmuth?
Yeah.
Steiner's assistant, Waschmuth. Was it?
Gunther Waschmuth.
That's it, yeah. And
yeah, he was Steiner's secretary for the last 20 years of Steiner's life.
Uh-huh. An excerpt from the Etheric Formative Forces in Cosmos, Earth and Man. He published in 1932, and it's some really fascinating stuff for listeners to read on that as well.
Oh yeah, well, a lot of stuff that's in Waschmuth's book is now verifiable with very simple equipment on an ocean-going ship. I have a lot of film showing this, time-lapse film, which you really can't argue with it, and for example, in the summer, in the winter time, there is a flow of etheric force that comes out of the northern section of the Earth, and it flows towards the south. Well, you can block that flow locally with shipboard equipment, so that it builds up into rain while it is being photographed, and it'll come right over the ship. You see that happen, and it's been done hundreds of times, not just once or twice.
Yeah, I'm sure. So, the amount of times you've been at sea.
Yeah. But I have an ally in the British academic community. He's at one of the universities there, and he was responsible for exciting my original curiosity into a lot of these things, and he's now devastated by what I've done. Really, really exultant.
Yeah.
He's a PhD and everything like that. He's fully qualified. But, he was instrumental in turning my interest where it went.
Yeah. So what kind of equipment on a ship would you use? Would it be like a pea gun that you were talking about?
Yes, anything like that will work. Pea gun, unfortunately, didn't come along until after.
Okay.
I was through with the Merchant Marine, and I had to entrust the pea guns that I had, that I was able to make, and put aboard the Maui with one of the officers there that was a friend of mine that would do this, and it just made colossal upheavals in the weather with him tying it to a halyard on the flying bridge. Just to, he said, "You better take it off because I'm going to get into trouble otherwise." Which is really what would happen. He would just get into difficulty. They'd tell him to take it down and make it hot for him.
So what exactly is a pea gun, just for listeners to...
A pea gun is a simple empty tube. There's nothing in the tube at all. But the tube has mirrors in the end of it, so that it has a two-way mirror there. And that is the secret to making it work, is that the mirror that reflects through the tube from the end empties the ether out of the tube, because the ether will not go against the mirror. That's a cardinal principle of what I've discovered. And that produces the low potential within the tube. And the low potential is what feeds into the higher potential outside, because that's the way the ether works. It flows from low potential to high. It's a complete different to every other potential that I know about in the world, where the flow is always from the high potential to the low.
Wow.
But this flows from low to high, and that bamboozles the people from the university most of the time.
Wow.
But it works. And that's all that counts, really, is does it work?
Yeah, absolutely. The end of the summer, I'll be experimenting with this on my own boat. It won't be a ship, but it'll be a 34-foot boat in the Caribbean somewhere. So I will actually take this on board and try a few things, but I don't think...
Well, you're going on a sailboat, right?
Yeah, but... This will be around the hurricane season.
Well, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that if I were you.
No.
I wouldn't fool with it. Not on a sailing boat.
No, not on a sailing boat. Okay.
No.
I'll take your advice.
Really, it doesn't work too well on any small craft.
Uh-huh.
Because the motions are
too
precipitate, they're too wide, to get a really good response. It's nothing comparable at all to a vessel that's 720 feet long.
Yeah, because you're going at different knots as well.
It's like driving a building around.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I obviously see the difference there. Oh, that's wonderful. One of the examples you use that you give in your book, Guarding the Rain Engineering Works, one of the governments that were brave enough to give your work a trial was the Malaysian government.
Yes.
That was Anwar Ibrahim.
That's right. Anwar Ibrahim is a great man, and he will come again also. He was ousted from the government by... underhanded means, and beaten up and subjected to a horrible level of punishment and so forth. But he has survived it all, and I expect that eventually he will become Prime Minister of Malaysia. I would be very surprised if he doesn't. But I thought he was a splendid individual, because he took me right into his office and listened to what I had to say.
Mm-hmm.
And he saw that... I was a straight-ahead guy, and not in any sense going to chisel on him or anything like that. And he got busy and got the bureaucracy out of the way and got us going. And we made rain in Malaysia because of him.
That's fantastic. There were 10 days of wild rain.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Wow.
That's right. And the at night, the city of Kuala Lumpur was like it was under a bombing attack. I mean, it was tremendous lightning came in, and I guess it scared just about everybody. I have film of that, too.
And that was after 4.5 months of regional drought.
That's right. That's right.
That's just incredible. I mean,
yep.
It's just staggering that we're sitting on this incredible technology that you have developed. And this was back in 1998 that you did this, but you've been working on this...
1991.
No, 1991.
Right.
And you've been working on this for a long, long time now. You've been sitting on this technology for a very long time.
Right.
And the governments just do not want it to be made available to humanity.
Well, that opens up really the key to the whole thing, which
mm-hmm.
is that the individuals, the wealthy oligarchic individuals that actually control the world,
mm-hmm.
they want world drought.
Yeah.
That is their particular policy that they follow. So they stifle every opportunity that you get to deal with drought. They come in and they talk to the prime minister or the president or whoever it is in a particular country, and he goes down like a pricked balloon. He doesn't really want to get the drought beaten after he's talked to the oligarchs. They make sure that he loses interest. He loses interest, or out he goes.
And they profit from drought.
Yes, of course they profit from drought, because they are, wanting to sell water at extremely inflated prices. They want to charge the ordinary working person for just for a glass of water.
Yeah.
They figure it's the new oil age to them.
Blue gold.
That's, they can't think any higher than that.
Yeah. But yeah, I've heard about this. I heard that Bush, or he sent one of his daughters down to Paraguay to buy up some 150,000 acres of water-rich land, and he'd already bought 150,000 acres. So they've got 300,000 acres of water-rich land in Paraguay, and
yes.
they're selling off all this, all the last mineral water stocks. And as you say, water's going to be the new blue gold. We're going to see a horrific situation with drought and water being withheld from people.
That's right. That's
yeah.
right. And being forced to pay through the nose just for a glass of water. That's their dream.
Yeah.
That's that's the way they look at life. And I wouldn't want their karma, I'll tell you that.
No, that's true. I mean, privatization of water has been going on since dear old Margaret Thatcher brought the idea.
Right.
But I was following this in the early 2000s, the early noughts, because George Monbiot did a massive lecture on the subject of privatization of water in Africa, and how
yes.
poor African families were being forced to have water meters in their homes when they could barely afford to pay, you know, for the fees to keep these water meters running, which means they were forced to go and drink choleric water from the river.
Yes.
And, you know, this situation that you're talking about will just make this a whole lot worse for people in developing countries.
Well, especially when you figure that they don't have to have that type of thing at all.
Exactly.
All they need is a very, very primitive aeroplane and one of my tubes, and they can have all the water they can use.
Yeah.
So they are at pains to prevent my doing that.
Yeah.
And, it's really surprising that I'm still alive.
Yeah.
All things considered.
It's fantastic. You've obviously
yeah.
got angels taking good care of you. They do say that it's the greatest honour to be assassinated by the oligarchic system.
Yes, right, that's right. That's true.
I mean, the thing is, this has to change. This system has to change for people to be able to access this amazing technology. I mean, say if somebody educated themselves on this particular subject and a community, a localized community, tried out small experiments, say from the ground. I mean, I wouldn't know terrestrially if people could generate rain in a local area using a pea gun. Is that possible?
Well, they could do that, but they could use you know, primitive methods of accumulating rain. That's happened in the UK all over there. Down in Cornwall, for example, there's this special means of accumulating rain. Really digging holes in the ground and filling them with specific types of rocks that accumulate rain. That can be done. But that's, you know, that's not a mass solution, let's put it that way. I mean, how do you get water into London, for example, a colossal city like that? Mm-hmm. You have to have, access to the overhead where it is all stored for you. Mm-hmm. All you got to do is get it down. And we know how to do that now.
Mm-hmm. But say, because obviously your system, I mean, can work well in areas where there's a tropical rain.
But
how would de Meyer's work in Africa? He's done some experiments in Africa to create rain.
Yes, made huge lakes.
And did he do that
in northeastern Africa?
In eastern Africa.
No doubt about it. I mean, he created those lakes. You couldn't see across them.
Wow.
But I don't know, you know, what he's done since. But, I mean, it can be done. And governments just don't want to do it. They are afraid of the oligarchy because that is how they lose power. If they displease the oligarchy, out they go, one way or another. Mm. By murder, if need be. So it calls for, constant agitation and work by dedicated people to get this into human use.
Well, that's it.
The fact that it's so simple is really a great thing. It's a marvelous thing, really.
Yeah, this is what, makes me very passionate about getting people to know your work. I mean, obviously, there's people out there who do know of your work, but there's, now there's a movement towards, I think people are beginning to wake up and realize that sustainability is the way to release ourselves as currency from the capitalistic system,
Yeah, that's right.
If we can possibly use these techniques, say, in areas where we have new sustainable communities, self-sustaining communities that are able to develop their own alternative energy, their own water technology with your rain engineering techniques and processes. You know, if people were able to get together in a community and do that, you know, then we could have a blueprint there, so to speak, of self-sustaining communities that survive outside these capitalistic systems. And, you know, we no longer could they control people. But obviously,
that's right.
You know, it
that's
sounds
right.
very idealistic, but it's something that people are beginning to see, I think.
There's no doubt about it. The number of people that get in touch with me that want to, invade my website and so forth is really quite astonishing. I can't deal with it, really. There's too many.
Really?
I have to tell them to read the book and, go out and do it. But, because there's enough information in the book and in the the videos that I've made for the people to see how to do it. It's perfectly obvious that you could do it. If you were, you'd need some intelligence and some understanding of the ethers and so forth, but they could do it. And the thing is, they want someone else to do it. Someone else to, you know, to take the hits.
You see, that's the kind of conditioning, kind of, it's embedded in our consciousness to expect everybody else to do these things for us, and we really do need to realize that in order to survive, and as I said, you know, be autonomous, we've got to self-educate.
Yes, that's very true.
Which book were you talking about? The Cosmic Pulse of Life, or you said that it's in your book?
Well, the Loom of the Future is a book that gives most of the detail about the weather engineering work, at least prior to the airborne development.
Uh-huh.
And the airborne use of P-guns automatically obsoleted everything else. It was so efficient, so effective, that, you know, you wouldn't want to be bothered going around on the ground finding a place to put your guns or to have people not interfere with them and that sort of thing. That there were a constant problem. It was a constant problem with the ground-based guns, and it was far more efficient to put them on an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, as simple as that. And also, I think it would turn out in the long run to be much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
I have it now so that about an hour's flight out and back, that is a half hour out and a half hour back, you can make it rain just about anywhere other than in the Sahara, where there isn't enough chemical ether to make it work.
That's just fantastic.
It's all light ether and you know, variants that are not water-bearing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's The Loom of the Future. That's the book that you're talking about. The one that's said is going to be
coming out in about 90 days. They're doing it now.
Okay. And that was with the book tree.
800-700-TREE. That's how you get that.
Yeah. That's if you live in the States. Of course, I've got some
listeners. If you live in the States, right.
I've got some listeners that don't, so I don't know how they would get hold of that copy, but I know that I did have a look on Borderlands, and I looked on Amazon as well, so other people can order this book.
Yeah, you can get the book tree is P.O. Box 16476, 16476,
okay.
San Diego, California, 92176. You can get the Cosmic Pulse of Life from them now.
Right.
That's the way you do that, and their street address, I don't know. I don't remember.
No, that's enough information.
I guess PO Box 16476 is good enough.
Yeah, I think so. Well, that's great. People from Europe and elsewhere. There's a lot of people from Asia that are listening to this show, as well as Japan, actually. So.
Uh-huh. Well, it's for the Japanese and the Chinese, they should be aware that the ether is really the qi.
Yeah.
What they call the qi in Asian medicine is the orgone energy of Wilhelm Reich. That's what he did was make the qi scientific. He made the measurements and everything else, and actually proved that the qi was real and capable of development. And they don't pay any attention to it.
Yeah.
They prefer to be, you know, to leave it in the hands of the doctors and be bamboozled by them.
Yeah. Well, I definitely...
That's really what the orgone energy is. It is the chi of Asia.
It is.
In a scientific form.
I have to agree with you. I trained in Qigong just over a year ago. Did an intensive course and learnt something called the eight qi awakening animal forms, and I learnt some other basic qigong stuff, And I did this for personal health reasons, because since I was 14 I've had quite a number of benign tumours, and then the last one I had was precancerous, and that was in my lymphatic system. So I decided to do something about it, because Western medicine wasn't really addressing the root cause of it. So I did this traditional Chinese medicine course and learned a bit about Chinese herbs as well, and it really taught me a lot about the 12 meridians that go through the human body, and they are the pathways for qi or orgone. And I started doing Tai Chi and the Qigong, and it's just completely changed my life.
Yes, of course.
It's restored the energy, you know, in my life force energy and in my Dantian, and it's amazing. Like if I burn my fingers or if I hurt myself, I heal a lot quicker.
Yes, of course.
You know, and I'm able to recharge myself, like energy-wise, when I need
it,
by just doing some Tai Chi, because I know how to, with those particular movements, which are based on the 5,000-year-old knowledge, where these, you know, Chinese doctors have studied this force.
Energy. Well, most people don't realize that in China, 3,000 years ago, that's 2,000 years before America was even thought of, that they had a complete pharmacological system that worked.
That's,
you know,
right.
it was based on controlling the qi.
Well, it's even traced back to 5,000 years.
Yes.
Which is just absolutely fascinating.
That's right.
Ancient knowledge that we're sitting on here.
That's right. Well, they're sitting on that. For example, the medical profession doesn't know anything about the qi. They don't know anything about life force. They don't know anything about anything except drugs. You know, how to give you dope. That's modern medicine.
The American pharmaceutical companies are only about 80 years old, and they're already controlling the world.
That's right.
Yeah, and
people are, you know, getting upset about our president's medical system, and you know, it's no system at all, really. It's just a means of diverting everybody into the clutches of the pharmaceutical industry.
That's right.
Which they really need to avoid rather than get into.
Yeah, that's a whole other subject, really, isn't it?
Yes, it sure is.
But mind you, that's good. That's something else that you sent me, which is just really fascinating as well. Is a book review you wrote for, oh gosh, another difficult name, Batman Gell, what's his name?
Batman Gellage.
Batman Gellage, thanks for rescuing me there.
Yes, the Water Doctor.
Yeah, this is a feature published in Borderlands, a quarterly journal.
Right.
And
yeah, Dr. Batman Gellage, he died a few years ago when he came back from a tour of Europe, a triumphal tour of Europe, and he had wanted me to go with him and show my weather films on his program, and I had, at that time, I had recovered from a stroke, and I didn't want to do anything to bring it on again,
mm-hmm.
and so I said, no, doctor, you go by yourself, and you know, I'll see you when you come back. But when he came back, he got right into a blizzard in New York State, and he contracted pneumonia and passed away.
That's very sad.
And I lost a good friend there.
I'm so sorry.
But he was marvelous in bringing the importance of water as a healing agent and as a conditioning agent for the human organism. I mean, we just simply do not drink enough water, and most of the diseases that we have that are, you know, that they're trying to defeat with the chemicals are overcome by undertaking adequate water intake.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you have to do, and this is what he taught.
That's really good
MD out of British University, trustworthy man, but they heard him not.
No. And he was researching this while he was in prison.
Yes, he was. He was in prison in Tehran, and they said, "Well, we're gonna you're not such a bad guy. We're gonna let you out." And he said, "No, I'm gonna finish my research. Mm-hmm. I'll stay in for another 6 months."
That's so convincing.
So he voluntarily stayed in prison in Tehran until his research was finished on water.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Have you heard of Dr. Masaru Emoto?
Uh-huh.
He's a Japanese doctor who also did some research on water.
Right. Particularly on the crystalline forms and so forth that can be made to appear out of water, how they outpicture the condition of the water and its suitability for consumption,
mm-hmm.
or to be rejected, as the case may be, and how you can damage water just like you would damage a living organism. You can damage water very definitely by mishandling,
yeah,
and putting it through pipes and so forth. That all of it is bad for you.
Well, he was also doing research into how human thoughts affect water.
Right, correct.
And
yeah.
He was, anyone can look this up on the web. Masaru
right.
Emoto, he was, as you say, doing research with the water with crystals and seeing how human thoughts affect these crystals and the different, he took pictures of different crystals under different thought focuses,
mm-hmm.
and got some very interesting results there, and you got some really beautiful crystals from very loving thoughts and emotions, and then some really distorted strange looking ones from some very negative thought forms. And that is also very fascinating when you think about how, the other doctor's work goes back to, you know, how much water we have in our body, and obviously, you know, we're affecting our whole bodies with our feelings and emotions, and how that has an effect on our health as well.
Yes.
Interesting stuff. And also, have you heard of Dr. Albert Abrams, who I think he started...
Yes, he was a San Francisco doctor.
Yeah.
Who was also out of the university in Europe. I forget which one it was. It was one of them over there. He got a gold medal over there. And Abrams was hated by the medical profession here. They did everything they could to undo him. But he laid the basis for the work of Dr. Ruth B. Drown, whom I knew very well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
It's in The Cosmic Pulse of Life, the complete story of my relationship with her. And Dr. Abrams found that live tissue and diseased tissue had two different rates of vibration. And he went on to find a way to tap this, to verify, you know, what the vital force was in the particular organ or tissue, and built up a system, the basic system on which Ruth Drown erected hers. And Ruth Drown became, world famous in her time for developing what we can now see is 21st century medicine. But of course she was absolutely blasted and bombarded by the medical bunch here in the most unbelievable way. But that's normal for a person who has something that is useful to mankind. You've got to go against the anti-mankind forces, which exist in the world and are here to be... You have to push against them.
Yes, you do.
So...
Yeah. Oh,
but Ruth Drown took cross-sectional pictures of the human body, and I saw her do this many times, and not a stranger to her more intimate moments, and these pictures today are far superior to what you get with an MRI or anything like that. I mean, they are cross-sectional right through the tissue, go right through bone and right through blood and everything like that. You can see everything.
That's amazing.
And, this is a marvelous woman, absolutely marvelous.
And what was the kind of technology that she was using?
Well, the technology has been subsumed under the term radionics since.
Yeah.
Since that time. But she was unique in that she was able to take photographs with her equipment.
That's incredible.
And these were on 8x10 cut film, and you would take them out of the processing and put them on an X-ray viewer and look at them just like you would an X-ray, except that they were cross-sectional. And there's one of these pictures is in the Cosmic Pulse of Life. It's a picture that the ordinary person would be very, very easily able to understand, in as much as it is a photograph of a tooth, a tooth that is abscessed.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the outline of the tooth and the way it sits in the gum and so forth. You can see the veins in the pulp in the tooth are cross-sectioned. They're like little white, little black dots. That's the blood in the tooth. And there is a sinus of infection going through to the interior of the patient's mouth. It's all there in cross-section.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, she took thousands of pictures of people through the years this way. And never got any recognition for it at all. It's terrible.
What?
So anybody, you know, that thinks that this is a free country or that sort of thing, they're all wet. It's just not true.
I don't think anyone that listens to my show thinks.
Well, when people like this, you know, good people that are they're working for mankind, when they are set upon by blackguards, people who are blackguards, and they're allowed to do that, it's pretty darn sick.
you said that she had a difficult time. What was her fate?
Her fate was eventually to have a stroke.
Okay.
After she was arrested and thrown into jail at the age of 72, and before she could come to trial on these trumped-up charges that they were going to attack her with, she simply died. And I figured that she'd just had enough of mankind to last her for a long time. But she died, you know, as a consequence of being assailed that way.
Was this a federal prison by any chance?
No, this was in California.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And what were the charges? I mean, to charge a doctor...
Well, the charge was that they hired a person to go to her as a patient complaining of certain things and get her to make a diagnosis, and then they said, well, this is not true, this person doesn't have these things, we've got all these doctors that say she doesn't, yet you say she does, so we're going to charge you with fraud. And so
they set
you know, she was torpedoed.
Yeah. Well, it's usually the way they do this, isn't it? To sabotage
right.
people's work, they set you up.
That's right, that's exactly
yeah.
it. But really, people have told me that the story of Ruth B. Drown is worth the price of the Cosmic Pulse of Life all by itself. The chapter in there called Chapter 14 is called Criminal or Genius. And, you know, you can take your pick after you've read it as to which you believe.
Mm.
But I was of no doubt that she was a really superior individual.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's just marvelous.
Wow.
And then to be associated with her was one of the high points of my own life. It was really, really spectacular.
Well, you're an incredible person as well, and the work you've done is very pioneering, and it's based on other people's very pioneering work. So, It doesn't surprise me that you have had contact with such people.
Well, pioneering is no piece of cake, I'll tell you.
Well, exactly. It's not an easy path you've chosen.
Well, it's cost me a lot, I'll say that in many ways. I've you know, paid a very heavy price for it in terms of things worldly, but I'm happy.
I am sure.
At least I did my part.
I think that's wonderful, and I'm sure that everything that you have done and achieved will be realized. It will come out, you know, and now is
yes.
the time, because, you know, the veils are crumbling.
There's a group down in Brisbane, Australia, that has really comprehended, you know, the magnitude of my contributions and what could be done with them and from them, and they are going to put it all together into a film that can be distributed throughout the world. And they now have a big problem down there with smog. Well, I took care of Los Angeles smog in 1990 in the most successful operation we'd ever had with ERE. And, you know, they just didn't look at it. They didn't want to look at it.
No. Well, again, they profit from pollution as well as drought, don't they?
That is correct. That's right. The big capitalists, you know, they want it to go on just like it is. And if they'd have taken up my technology, you wouldn't have any smog at all. And they won't have it in Brisbane either, because those guys are going to go ahead and make the equipment and install it, whether the government does it or not.
That's fantastic. That's just wonderful. I'd hope to hear more news on that story.
Yeah, call me up again sometime.
Oh, I will, certainly. I promise you.
I'll give you an update on that.
Absolutely.
How that's going.
Well, there's so much to go through.
It's very easy to do. I mean, nobody has to have smog. It's easy to get rid of it. And as long as you've got AC power, you can get rid of it.
Right.
Just make simple devices that dispel it. We had the most amazing year here in 1990 with smog. We actually hit it for six right out of the ballpark. It was just wonderful, but we couldn't interest the smog bureaucracy in it at all. They were making statements about what a wonderful improvement it was and everything else, and they had been told beforehand, before we started, that we were going to do this.
Yeah.
And no, they didn't react to it at all, other than to exult as though they had done it.
Oh, gosh, it's typical, isn't it?
And then the next year, you know, the smog went up 12%.
Oh, my goodness.
God. Yeah, fantastic.
Right. I wanted to talk about Jose Escamilla's work, Brought Me to
uh-huh.
You. He was the first person I interviewed for this show. And I was just blown away by his documentary, Moon Rising. And he refers to your work when you started filming these plasma orbs,
uh-huh.
or organisms, in the 1950s. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. 1957.
And
yeah.
So
57,
he,
58, 59.
So he was referring to you and your work, and I just wanted to ask you if you could tell listeners how you came about to start filming these creatures.
Well, the situation in the early 50s was that whatever factual information there was regarding the UFOs was in the hands of the government, and that they were not handing it out. They were kiboshing everything to do with the UFOs and the possibility of there being interplanetary spaceships or anything like that. The government had a complete lock on it altogether. Well, I directed my attention to one particular set of happenings that had occurred repeatedly in different parts of the world. And this was the instances where objects that were in the sky would disappear while they were under observation. They would vanish. In other words, they didn't go over the horizon or anything like that. They just vanished where they were.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, there were other objects that came into being right out of nowhere. This was another thing that was repeatedly reported, and nobody had any explanation for it. So you had objects materializing and dematerializing in the skies of the Earth. Well, a young guy like me, I said, where have they gone to when they disappear, and where have they come from when they appear?
Yeah.
So I said, we'll get some infrared film and see if they're not just around the corner somewhere. And that's how we. I started out with a local chiropractor, Dr. Jim Woods, and we started going out to the desert and taking these pictures of the empty sky. We never once saw one of these objects, but we got all these pictures on infrared. So that proved that that was where they went, was into the infrared, mm-hmm. and that they therefore had an existence in the infrared and could be accessed there. And I have no doubt that the government has subsequently gotten onto this, and otherwise they wouldn't have made that camera for $1 million to go into the ultraviolet. And the ultraviolet is a harmonic of the infrared. So that's really how I got on it. But they were able to fend us off. Even when we took movies of these things in the infrared, they were able to deal with all of it by just simply stalling and misrepresenting it and so forth. They didn't actually confront it and say, no, this didn't happen, or you didn't do it, or it's a fraud, or whatever. You know, they just said nothing most of the time.
But that's how it
started, and from that, of course, I went into rain engineering, and that's a story in itself.
Yeah. With the infrared and the ultraviolet, it's only heat bodies that show up on the camera. No dust or
that's
ice
right.
or anything like
that's
that.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. You can't see them with the unaided eye. You can't see these objects, and they can be right there. They could be looking at you, so to speak, and you wouldn't know they were present because you can't see that they're there. But we know from years of experience with this that they're there pretty much all the time, and you can get pictures of them virtually any time you want. The thing is that you need to make of yourself a focus for them, something that they can see you are from the infrared, which we did with the aid of that device called the star exercise, where you circulated your body in a methodical way, and each time you got on one of these resonance points, you could feel a pulse going out from you, and you would go through maybe 100 repetitions of this exercise, by which time you could hardly even move. You had the system wound up so tightly that it was difficult to move, and you know, the UFOs would come and look at you. that's basically it. See what they're, in other words, there was something that went across the blockage between the infrared and the red, let's put it that way, that enabled them to see you and to oscillate around you, and we got pictures like that. So it was very far out work in that time, and a lot could be done with it today if you had the funding, but the funding is not available for anything like that. It's only available for people that want to hurt other people.
Yeah.
There's plenty of funding available for the military.
What do you mean by star exercise?
The star exercise is it's fully laid out in the cosmic pulse
okay.
of life.
Yeah.
And you spread your legs, comfortably apart, and hold your arms out parallel to the ground, and then you oscillate your body through the various cardinal points, north, south, and north, south, east, and west, in a rhythmic way, and you build up a definite force pattern through this, especially if you go up over 100 repetitions, 100 rotations,
That sounds like it could be just the movement of chi through the body, because, I mean, when you do a lot of qigong, you certainly feel that.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of, got its roots based in early shamanic dances, and there's a lot of spinning and movement in that respect, because I think they studied the earth's energy, and there's an energy that spirals up into the ether and spirals down, and you can see that
uh-huh.
with the way trees and plants and everything grows with these spiral kind of forming. So I'm wondering if perhaps that your star exercise was agitating some chi flow there.
No, I'm sure it does.
Yeah.
I'm sure that what you feel is an accumulation of chi, and it also focuses all your vehicles down into a central point. You know, normally you're scattered all over the place, average
yeah.
person is.
Yeah.
And when you do the star exercise, you center all your vehicles into a central point. And it's very beneficial.
And this attracts these...
Right, well, they can see that. They can see, you know, when you get it built up into reasonably intense field around you, they can see that across the barrier between the infrared and the visible.
That's just fantastic. Well, I'm definitely going to be experimenting. Try and get pictures. With the famous tether incident that you talk about in this information that you sent me, I know that people can look that up on YouTube. That was with the Columbia shuttle, and
right,
and
1996.
Yeah, well, it says that the tether broke loose and drifted. Well, that's also one that Jose Escamilla uses in his Moon Rising documentary, and you can see there these plasma organisms, or UFOs.
Yes.
Yeah,
there's 30 of them, 30 or 40 of them in the in the sky around the spacecraft. Well, they're actually 80 miles away, but you can figure out from the 12 mile length of the tether that these UFOs are at least 2 miles in diameter. So they're big.
Yeah, I've tried to present that to a few people, and they say, "Oh, that's just dust," and I'm like, "Well, dust doesn't show up on that kind of camera."
Yeah, that's right. It's got to be an ultraviolet.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no way out of it being what it is.
Yeah.
I don't know how this got into the public domain. I really don't. But they got it in, and they used it. And it's in the cosmic pulse of life. You can see it. See, the Taylor incident is in there. And I think it's 18 or 20 UFOs in one of the pictures, along with the tether itself from the spacecraft. So it's beyond argument.
Have you heard about the increased sightings of plasma orbs, especially over England, actually? But these you can see with the human eye. They're these orange glowing balls of heat bodies, and I spoke to Susan Joy Renison, who says that, you know, again, these are conscious beings. They're alive, and she thinks that they're accumulating because of the earth changes here. And she was saying that the Russians were doing observations, probably using your type of camera, and they're seeing a mass exodus of some organisms and others coming in using the infrared technology. So there's a kind of shift of these organisms that we can't see with the human eye leaving and entering the planet because of Earth changes as well. What's your opinion on that?
Well, I have had a contact with the orb phenomenon through a medical doctor in Northern California who's a friend of mine, and I have a package of them here, a package of pictures of them here. So they're not news to me in the sense that he has them around his house up there and his daughter can call them in, so to speak. And they come in answer to her call. So they are elemental beings of some kind. And I've seen enough of them to know that they're absolutely authentic, that there's no argument about that. And they're all colors, green, red, blue, all over. They're all colors of the rainbow. And they're seen all over the world. There isn't any country, I don't think, that hasn't been visited by the orbs. They're a reality of life.
Yeah.
But the scientific professions, of course, are very slow to get onto this.
Yeah.
And they probably treat somebody that that they wanted to tackle them, they would say that it wasn't a good thing for him to do, and he would have trouble getting a job, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you've obviously heard about the crop circles that we have here, especially in the western part of England and southwest. And I have contact who went down there a year ago and stayed with a farmer, and a crop circle appeared that day, and he also saw a really small orb, these much, much smaller orbs. They're not like the orange glowing balls that people see, but they're kind of small and white light, and
yeah, they're about maybe 6 inches in diameter.
Yeah.
That's about how the ones that I've seen are.
The people in the countryside see them so often, every day. They, you know, especially around the time that these crop circles are forming, and so they just, you know, it's just it's taken for granted now.
Yes.
It's just fascinating. What's your view on their existence? Do you feel that they're just, you know, here along with every other?
That's right.
They're doing their thing.
They're part of the whole life of the earth.
Yeah.
I made this point in Cosmic Pulse of Life about the cave drawings down in Cantabrian Spain and so forth that. You know, these drawings go back 3,000 years B.C.
Yeah.
And they were here then, and there's UFOs in amongst these drawings, and they're admirably representational, the drawings themselves, because horses and ibex and bison and everything else are in there, and they're recognizable for what they are, and you have to accept that the UFOs were here in 3,000 B.C.
Mm-hmm.
And that's...
That's right.
You know, that's...
There's even petroglyphs.
Yeah, a Paleolithic man knew that UFOs were here.
Yeah.
It's the scientific people that are behind the times.
I've seen some petroglyphs with spirals in the sky as well.
Yes.
Which is quite interesting, hence the recent Norway spiral. What's your view on that particular incident?
I don't know anything about that.
Mm.
I can't offer anything.
Well,
just,
that it's very.
But I know that the human eye is just a tiny little crack into into the whole of the vibrational spectrum. It's just almost nothing.
Exactly. And we're very arrogant to measure everything by the human five senses when we're completely negating a whole spectrum of organisms and creatures and energy and ether which exist outside of the measurement that we've founded science upon.
Yes.
Mm.
That's right. We're very arrogant species.
Mm-hmm.
And we do well once in a while just to figure the brevity of on which modern materialistic science rests. It's not more than 300 years at the most that it's been in existence, and that's nothing compared with the age of the cosmos, even what we admit to. But when you figure that we're looking through a very, very small chink in the visible range into what is visible and what isn't, and we see almost nothing, really, with our unaided vision.
Mm-hmm.
And we look through a microscope and go down, we intensify the vision, and here's a whole world down there that we didn't know existed without the microscope. And then there it is, Well, you can figure the same thing when you expand the sensitivity of the human eye with things like the videotape that the American government made, that this stuff is there all the time. I mean, it hasn't come from anywhere else. It's not a it's not something that came from Mars or Venus or Pluto. It's it's just part of the world, part of the whole world. And we're very reluctant to advance to this. We're more concerned with how we can turn what we learn into destructive knowledge.
Yeah. And there's absolutely fascinating information on your website. Again, it's www.rainengineering.com. One of the stories that grabbed me was the Morley Martin. Looking down the microscope and finding these creatures just coming out of nowhere.
That's right. I've got them out of azoic rocks.
Yeah, that's just
mind-blowing. Rewrite all the books, that say that these predate life on Earth. Azoic rocks have never disclosed any fossils. And
yeah.
Morley Martin.
Exactly. I mean, that goes just totally beyond what I learned when I was studying the evolution of Earth and life and everything, and it just blew me away. It was just incredible.
Amazing, amazing guy.
So, he died in 1938, and he published a small brochure called The Reincarnation of Animal and Plant Life from Protoplasm Isolated from the Mineral Kingdom, which appeared in 1934. And it's just
there was a naval commander that was present there, and he looked through the microscope and he saw these things under there, and he saw the claws materializing and everything, and he saw the legs and claws materialize on one of these things under the microscope, and it walked off the microscope field. Come out of azoic rocks. And so they countered that by saying, well, he didn't... He didn't use a proper sterilization and so forth.
Mm.
Well, he did everything to incandescence, and still these things appeared.
It's just incredible. That's awesome. Really is. As you say, when did life appear on Earth?
That's right.
But rather, when was there not life on Earth?
That's right.
And
that is correct.
That is just, really the foundation of all your amazing work, really.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
You've given a great gift to people, and it's a great honor again to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure, and you can call me again sometime when that smog thing progresses down in Brisbane.
I will.
They don't have to spend a lot of money to do that, because that is where the problem is that they get to spend money on something and then they want to do it. But you know, if you don't need to spend the money, why would you worry?
Yeah.
But somebody is draining it off into their personal account. That's what happens with it. I'm sure of that.
Well, you know, what we really need to do is get people looking into this deeply, and, you know, we could start a whole orgone and a pegon revolution.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Well, a pegon is a revolution, all right. No doubt about that.
That would be a wonderful thing. So, Trevor, thank you so much for coming on to Sailing Beyond Knowledge.
All right, well, my pleasure to be here, and call me again sometime.
I will, thank you, and thanks for your time, and I'll send you a copy of this on disk, if you like.
That'll be nice. I'd like to have that.
Okay, lovely, and I'll be in touch very soon. Have a lovely
day. Okay, Carla,
okay.
Be well.
Take care, you too. Thank you again.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye.
This is soaring. Come on now, stand for something. Oh yeah, so stand for something. Come on now, stand for something. Or else, so life is for living. Rest when your days are over. So dance and leap for joy. No chance for another. Find something to believe. I lift you up when you are under. Gonna stand for something, or you will fall for everything. Come on, life is for living. Rest when your days are over. So dance and leap for joy. No chance for another. Find something to believe. Lift you up when you are under. Gonna stand for something, or you will fall for everything. Come on. Thank you very much. We have a Kwame Day. So stand for something, come on now, stand for something. Or else, so stand for something, come on now, stand for something. Oh yeah, so stand for something, come on now, stand for something. Or else, so stand for something, come on now, stand for something. Or else, so stand for something, come on now, stand for something. Or else, so stand for something, come on now, stand for something. Or else, or else.